You are listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, B.C. CJLY 93.5 FM on your radio dial. Welcome to Peace Watch Middle East, an exploration of peacemakers and peacemaking in the Middle East. Specifically, the Peace Watch Middle East series talks to people on both sides, Palestinians and Israelis. They may be engaged in nonviolent direct action, or in bicultural cooperation, or in the development of civil society. On the last edition of Peace Watch Middle East, I talked to Noah Nativ and Lina Dalashe from the Israeli peace group Ta'ayush, Jewish Arab Partnership. This week, I spoke with George N. Rishmawi and Netta Golan, two of the founding members of a Palestinian peace group called the International Solidarity Movement. ISM has brought Palestinians, Israelis, and other internationals together in hundreds of nonviolent actions to witness events and to end the Israeli occupation. The group is probably best known for the time in April when some of its members made their way into Bethlehem's Nativity Church at a time when it was under siege by the Israeli military. More recently, they've just finished the Olive Harvest campaign. In this, they joined forces with other peace groups in Israel and Palestine to help Palestinian farmers harvest olives when they were denied access to their land, either by settlers or by the military. George N. Rishmawi is a well-known Palestinian in the nonviolent resistance to the occupation. He coordinates a Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People in Bet Sahur near Bethlehem. The Rapprochement Center was established in 1988 to stimulate dialogue between Palestinians and Israelis. George is also one of the founding members of the International Solidarity Movement. He and colleague Netta Golan traveled across Canada and then into the U.S. on a speaking tour. I spoke to them while they were in Victoria. I asked George how he got involved in nonviolence.
Okay, actually I started being involved in the nonviolent resistance in 91 when I joined the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. And I joined that in the first action that that I knew about that rapprochement did, which was a mass activity, which was a candle procession organized by the dialogue group that the Rapprochement Center had started in 1988.
The what kind of group? I missed that.
That was a Palestinian-Israeli dialogue group.
A dialogue group, I see.
It started in 1988 in the first Intifada, and it was kind of an attempt to find a common ground and joint work to resist the occupation. The Rapprochement Center is in the town of Bet Sahur, near Bethlehem, and it was one of the early groups that started dialogue with Israelis, but I guess the bases were different in this dialogue group because it was meant to be another venue of resistance for the Palestinians, in which they did not drop the Intifada as an option, because it was always mentioned as a part of the Intifada in Bet Sahur. And this organization was involved in other nonviolent activities in the town of Bet Sahur, and especially that the biggest kind of nonviolent resistance example was the tax revolt, where the people in Bet Sahur refused to pay taxes to the occupation. And this actually has increased the credibility of this organization among the population in Bet Sahur and help them to continue with the work. to expand a little bit about this tax resistance, which is very much important to the for the future activities that we are doing, that have been organized later on.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, the tax resistance was basically a collective attempt by the people of Beit Sahur to refuse to pay tax to the Israeli occupation, based on two principles. One is that this is not our government, it's an occupation government. Second, that people pay taxes to get services, and when we pay taxes to the occupation, we get weapons to kill us, and tear gas, and siege, and all of this military. The principle was like the Americans used, no taxation without representation. And the result for this refusal was actually a siege for about 42 days from the town of Beit Sahur, house arrest, sometimes 24 hours, sometimes all night, a confiscation of furniture from the houses of the people who were supposed to pay taxes, goods from their shops, and machines from their factories, cars, and sometimes money if they found in the houses. And that was around $5 million, American dollars, that was confiscated from Beit Sahur, which left it with a damaged infrastructure and caused the town a lot of economic troubles for the next 5 or 6 years at least. This attempt actually was not duplicated or repeated in any other Palestinian village. One Palestinian village near Ramallah tried to do the same, but the Israeli measures were very difficult and hard and tough on the people and could not do it. Maybe one thing that helped the people to last for 42 days under curfew was that there was a kind of preparation in the town for civil disobedience, where many people were tried to be self-sufficient. They planted fields in their backyards, they raised chickens and rabbits and to get eggs and meat and, you know, all of that. And that was very helpful. And add to that, that the social fabric in this town was very helpful in, creating neighborhood committees in which they facilitated all of this kind of self-sufficiency process. Now, this has developed later on. I mean, the dialogue group developed on to be more of mass activities, non-violent activities, where Palestinians and Israelis and sometimes internationals joined. And I joined this organization in 91 when they had their candlelight procession, where about 5,000 people were there on December 25th, in the year 91.
And this included Israelis and internationals, as well as Palestinians from Beit Sahur?
Yes. Palestinians from Beit Sahur and also from other areas, mainly Bethlehem area. I became a volunteer in this organization until I graduated from school, and in 98 I was employed in their rapprochement center and continued with the dialogue group until the Intifada started in the year 2000. And based on my history as well, my previous, experience in the first Intifada, I was very much involved in the Intifada as any other Palestinian, nothing more or less. And I was arrested twice, once in 1989 during the tax campaign, the tax resistance, and the second time was in 1990, and in the second time I was under the administrative detention, where you don't have any information why you are in prison. Even the attorney did not even know why I was in prison, because this is what they classify as secret file.
What were you arrested for? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the first time there was a charge, there was a court. It was, the charge was blocking the street, you know, building barricades.
Mm-hmm.
And actually at that time, it was, they did not need me to confess doing that. because an Israeli soldier testimony was enough to convict me and send me to 4 months imprisonment and about $150 fine.
Where did you go to prison? Was that in inside?
This is an Israeli prison.
Inside the Green Line.
Not all of them, actually. No, none of them was inside the Green Line. I was in a prison near Hebron and another one near Ramallah. And in 1990, the second time when I was arrested, and I was in the Negev Desert prison, which is Ansar, or Ketzi'ot, they call it in Hebrew, and also another prison in the north, but it was not in the Green Line, inside the Green Line, it was in the West Bank. So these are detention camps, actually, that they have made during the first intifada to put Palestinian detainees and prisoners in there. So the administrative detention was for 2 months, and it was not renewed, but usually they renew it for reasons that they have, and they don't have to tell. This is a British law that was used during the British mandate against the local Palestinians there.
As I understand it, administrative detention means that there is no trial and no charge.
Nothing. No trial, no charge. You are just put in prison for a certain period of time, and it's renewable. And they tell you that it's renewed only maybe one day before you are supposed to be released.
How was your treatment during that period of time? How were you treated well? Were you?
The prison in Palestine, I mean, the Israeli jails are not like what people have in mind here about prison. It's not these rooms with the facilities and a chance to work or whatever. This is basically these detention camps were tents, and whether it's cold or warm, it's a tent that you will live in. There is an everyday 4 times count. So they count us 4 times every day to make sure that no one ran away. But if people look at that prison, it's in the middle of the desert, and nobody can run away anyway. But it's a way of humiliation. You are in a prison, and each section of the prison is divided into 5 major sections, and each of the 5 is divided into 4, where 75 people can be in each section. So it's small. Section, and it's tents, and there are, you know, barbed wire and fence around all the section, and the one that I was in was had even concrete walls just 2 meters high or 3 that you cannot see, you know, behind them, and on top there is a fence, so it's like a cage. From all sides it was closed. It's very humiliating, I mean, that you have to sit every day 4 times on the ground, and they just mention a number, and you have to say that you are there, because your name is not even mentioned. You are called as a number. And they don't look at you, I mean, as a human being in this way when you are mentioned as a number only. So many people actually have problems with sight if they go to that prison, because this prison is surrounded by artificial hills that they made where the ABC or a tank can drive on, and people cannot see more than 200 meters away. Everything that they will see after that is the sky and the horizon. So people who stay there for long times, and some people stay there for years, come out of prison, you know, with problems with their vision.
Do I understand correctly that, excuse me, that you were, at this time, you were also a student, that you were in school?
The first time I was in my 11th grade, which was 1989, and I was about 16 years old, I was born in 1973. And the second time was 1 year later, 1990. I finished high school, was about to get into university, and I had to wait 1 year before, because I lost the, like, admission exams and stuff like that, so I had to wait 1 more year to join the university.
My understanding is that the schools were also closed down during that period of time. I have to confess that I talked to another George Rishmawi.
My cousin, yeah.
Uh-huh. And so he did. He talked a little bit about this period of time from his perspective. But of course, you have a you're a different person, and you have a different experience of
but
that.
The only different experience is that I was arrested for these two times, and he was not. He was arrested only one time for a couple of days. He was on a list when he was stopped by the soldiers. His name was on the list, and they arrested him. And when I was stopped by the soldiers, also on the 24th of November, the year 1990, my name was also blacklisted and. And they arrested me from the street. So that was an arrest campaign, actually, that they did, because the army at that time was all over the town, everywhere in the Palestinian areas before the Oslo Agreement and before the redeployment. So the schools were closed in 1988 and part of 1989 as well. Universities also were closed, not only high school and even elementary schools, but also universities were closed, and most of the academic institutes in Palestine were closed, because they accused the student movement of being the troublemakers, you know. So, so it was for them the best solution, but eventually this did not stop any of the demonstrations or, you know, the stone throwing activities that Palestinians did. In this intifada and in the second intifada, I wanted also to be active. I was very active in the first one, and as a Palestinian who lived all my life under occupation, I cannot just sit silent, you know, doing nothing with regard to what Israel is doing to my people. And being involved in rapprochement and in the dialogue, maybe I could understand. Well, I managed to understand what exactly has to be done to affect the international community more, and this is what is needed. Actually, we need support from the international community, and the support is not money; it's a political support. I came to know that the main reason why people in the West, either in Europe or in the North American continent, or even in the world, are not siding with the Palestinians, because the whole conflict is viewed to them as a Palestinian aggression towards the State of Israel, which is the refuge for the Jews who were persecuted all the time and very intensively in the Holocaust. So, for many people, you know, who have good hearts and think that the Jews have the right to be safe, and the picture is viewed to them that we don't want the Jews to be safe, as Palestinians want to attack them and kill them, then it's obvious that the result of that will be that they will support the Israelis and be against the Palestinians. It's not because people are bad. It's the other way around. It's good because it's because people are good and they want to help. But if the conflict is viewed in its real image, and I'm very much convinced with this, then people will be with justice, because people are seeking justice. This is assuming that people are good in nature, and I believe that people are good in nature, especially the society, the group, the community, I mean the grassroots. I'm not talking about politicians and governments who have interests in different areas. And I have seen that in several occasions, and now in my cross-Canada tour together with Netta, I have seen that people have sympathy. And people are learning more about the conflict now, because there is more access to internet and media, which was not available in the first intifada. We hardly had faxes in the first intifada. I mean, now there are cellular phones, email, internet, and satellites, and many other Arab channels that maybe help in showing a certain real image, I mean, about the conflict in the Middle East. And that we are enabled now to come and talk to people here and meet them face-to-face and have human contact with them. Most of the people that I met, some people I met here in Canada, was for them the first time they meet a Palestinian. So how come they judge Palestinians of being, you know, savage and terrorist or whatever, and this is the first time for them to meet a Palestinian. It's because of the media, and we have a problem with the mass media that it is one-sided. I know that the Israelis or the Zionists are also accusing the media to be one-sided with the Palestinians, but we're calling for fair media, for both, not only for us. I became very much involved in the ISM in its beginnings, and you can say that I am one of the co-founders of ISM. And at the beginning of this intifada, I mean, in December 2000, there were calls, you know, to try to go on nonviolent demonstrations against the occupation and speak out loud as Palestinians and internationals and Israelis to against the Israeli, you know, military procedures in the Palestinian areas, knowing that when this intifada started, it started exactly like the first intifada. There was a spark, but this time the spark was Sharon's visit, and the Palestinians went on the streets with stones, like the first intifada exactly. However, the level of violence from the Israeli side on this, in this time, was much higher than the first time. So before any single Palestinian bullet was shot at Israelis, there were many Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers, machine guns and automatic rifles. And then there were lots of casualties among the Palestinians, which had many Palestinians to start, not many actually, but small groups, but had some Palestinians to carry their weapons and start, you know, shooting at the Israelis. Now, this happened, if we just go back a little bit with time, in 1996, 1997, when Israel decided to dig this tunnel under the Aqsa Mosque, there was a resistance and there were some military clashes, but it stopped. Then, later on, when they built the mountain of Abu Ghneim, when they confiscated the mountain and built the settlement of Har Huma, there was also some stone-throwing resistance and even a suicide bombing and some military resistance, but it also stopped. And in May 2000, protesting that the Palestinian prisoners are still in Israeli jails, Palestinian resistance members are still in Israeli jails, there were clashes and there was some exchange of fire, but this also stopped.
You're listening to Peace Watch Middle East on CJLY 93.5 FM, Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, B.C. I'm Jim Terrell, and I've been talking to George N. Rishmawi, a coordinator of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and a founding member of the International Solidarity Movement. George has been traveling across Canada with another founding member of the ISM, Netta Golan. Netta has lived in Canada on several occasions, but nowadays she reckons herself as an Israeli citizen living in Haaretz, just outside the Palestinian city of Nablus. Last March, she committed an act of civil disobedience when she sneaked past Israeli military forces and into Arafat's besieged Makata compound. She spent nearly a month in the compound and was eventually joined by other nonviolent international activists before she finally left Arafat and the Makata and moved on to other projects. Netta Golan talked to me over the phone from Victoria, where she and George Rishmawi were speaking. I asked her how she got involved in nonviolence as a form of political engagement.
Basically, you know, I was born in Tel Aviv in 1971, and despite the fact that the occupation started in 1967, I only found out about it when I was 15, because, you know, before the first Intifada, it was a non-issue in Israel. It was not in the mainstream discourse. When the Palestinian territories were referred to in our newspaper, they were called Judea and Samaria, the biblical names, and Gaza. Not, you know, no one, it was taboo then to use the occupied territories, even in the foreign press. Palestinians were also not referred to. There was Arabs. You know, the Palestinians were not affected by the kind of nationalism that, you know, the kind of European-style nationalism, and did see themselves before, you know, before 1948 or before the Zionist movement came to, you know, with the intention of taking over Palestine. They saw themselves as Arabs. Of course, this didn't change the fact that they were deeply rooted, you know, in Palestine. They're the indigenous people of that land, and their connection to that specific land is one, like any indigenous people, is very real, without, you know, without a need for nationalism to impose it. But so there was no, you know, Israel intentionally did not acknowledge any kind of national entity. There were Arabs, no Palestinians. I think it was Golda Meir who said, you know, that she was Palestinian, showing her passport from before, you know, from the British Mandate times. And saying there was no such thing. So that was pretty much, I was taught, like, Jewish history, you know, a history of oppression, you know, dispossession, ethnic cleansing, you know, acclimatizing with the Holocaust, which, even though I was third generation in Palestine, you know, born in Israel, was still very much a shadow over my head. And the message was, basically, we had always been victims, we had always been persecuted, and I understood that we never really harmed anyone, because that part of the story wasn't told. So when I first heard that there were people living under military rule that could be arrested without charges, you know, for length of time, that could be legally tortured, because torture was still legal in Israel until very recently, and it's still being practiced, even though it's illegal now. But and when I heard that, and when I heard that homes were being demolished as collective punishment in different, you know, I thought that the woman talking to me was talking about, you know, Argentina or, you know, something very far away. It was really a great shock to me to hear that she was talking about, you know, my country, because I could recognize, you know, the theme of oppression. But I wasn't used to, you know, Jewish people being on the oppressor side of that scale. It really came as a shock. I think I still shared the belief that many, that I think the majority of Israelis have, still have, what we're taught, which is that, you know, we are somehow morally superior than the Arabs. That's what we're taught. That they're different than us, that they're somehow inherently more violent than us. And these kind of racist assumptions are enforced, you know, through the images of violence that we are shown, you know, of suicide attacks or any kind of attack, without being shown the context from which it stems. And even more importantly, without being shown anything else, like we know nothing, I knew nothing about Palestinian culture, Palestinian society, Palestinians. You know, they were not, nothing of their humanity was ever, you know, I was never exposed to. All I was exposed to through the Israeli media was Palestinian violence. So I grew up with a lot of fear. And luckily, in the years of Oslo, I had a chance to begin to meet Palestinians. Before that, I remember that, you know, I remember talking to a kid at school who, you know, I was arguing, you know, our moral superiority, saying, you know, we would never, you know, commit a suicide bombing. We would never, you know, kill civilians. And I remember this kid asked me, like, what's the difference between phantom jet bombing a refugee camp and someone blowing himself up on a bus? And I answered, you know, very naively, Israeli phantom jets never bombed refugee camps. You know, but then when I went home and asked my dad, you know, did we ever do this? You know, he said, well, you know, the terrorists thought that if they would hide in the refugee camps, we would leave them alone. And I think that was the beginning of an understanding that really the difference between us isn't that they kill civilians and we don't, but that we have better weapons with which to do it. And I think that's a very big myth, you know, in Israeli society. Whenever we kill civilians, even though we do it almost every day, it's always viewed and presented as a mistake. Well, obviously, you know, a mistake that we committed in the process of defending ourselves. Well, you know, when Palestinians do it, it's intentional, and even when they attack, you know, army or armed settlers, it's a terrorist attack. So when I started going to meet Palestinians in the Oslo years, I was very surprised, you know, to hear from them that, as far as they were concerned, there was no peace process. Because, you know, for Israelis, the peace process was very real, actually. It wasn't really a process. We had peace, you know, because there was quiet, there was all this money coming in. Things were great. And then to hear from Palestinians that their situation was just getting worse, that it was so unbearable that they were predicting that if things didn't get better soon, you know, it would explode, was really shocking for me. I think I got to see during the time of the process how, you know, when people have an option, when people, you know, when the Palestinians had hope that negotiations were going to bring them, you know, freedom and independence, there was no need, you know, they did not resist, and they were willing to wait for years, even though during this waiting they saw, you know, they still had to be subject to daily humiliation at checkpoints, and saw their land, you know, continued to be taken away. They kept hoping that this route, the route of negotiations, you know, would bring results, would bring the desired results of independence. When it became 100% clear that wasn't going to happen, when, for example, Netanyahu decided to build the Har Chumah settlement, which is basically the last link in a ring of settlements surrounding occupied East Jerusalem, which basically makes it impossible for East Jerusalem to become the future capital of a future Palestinian state because it's surrounded by Jewish settlements from every side. The first response, you know, was definitely, you know, political. The negotiators were protesting. It got them nowhere. They were helpless to address it. Then there was nonviolent resistance. You know, people were squatting on the mountain. People like Faisal Husseini and Salah Tamari, and together with Israeli groups, were on that mountain protesting. Years of protesting and squatting there for the last month before it was actually the mountain was bulldozed to set down the foundations for the settlement, and the protesters were stormed and kicked off the land. And when that happened, it's like, you know, when any form of legitimate resistance is you know, proves to be, you know, completely ineffective, and people are both in despair and humiliated. You know, it becomes clear that, like, terrorism, you know, is only made possible, or is only supported by, you know, conditions where people feel like there's no other way that there's any hope in. And when this happened, when the Har Chumah settlement was created, I remember I was in Tel Aviv and visiting my dad, and I asked, you know, how what do you think about what Netanyahu has done? And he said, you know, it's good. We have to show them, you know, they can't tell us where to build. I said, and what if there'll be a suicide bombing? And I said this despite the fact that there hadn't been a bombing in years, but it was just clear that the temperature in the occupied territories had gotten beyond, you know, the boiling point where people would not, you know, it was just unbearable. It was clear that something was going to explode somewhere. And when I asked my father if this was a good thing, I asked, what if there would be a bombing? And he said, well, you know, it's a calculated risk. About an hour later, we heard there was a bombing. And it was close to the house. And my cousin, who was pregnant, you know, at the time, and just a really wonderful person, was one of the women that was killed in this bombing. And in the first moment when we heard about it, my father said, you know, I shouldn't have said it was a calculated risk. But very soon after, you know, it was just the man who did it, which he held, you know, responsible. For me, I think this was one of the, you know, situations in which, you know, my commitment to keeping avenues of resistance, nonviolent avenues of resistance open, was reconfirmed, you know, to make that kind of resistance possible and effective, so that people weren't forced, or weren't pushed, not forced, but pushed to kill, you know, themselves and others in trying to, you know, respond to the despair of having their land and their futures and their lives stolen from them. In the beginning of this intifada, which I already spoke about, when it became clear that the international community and the Israeli community was accepting, you know, the killing of unarmed demonstrators as a policy, that was when me and others decided to join, you know, nonviolent demonstrations, and saw the horrifying truth, which is, you know, that if, you know, that I and another, you know, person with blue blood can prevent Palestinians who are nonviolently resisting by, for example, trying to remove the roadblock that's suffocating their village, to do so without being murdered. While if we were not there, you know, they were being shot. And there was no way in which to hold, you know, anyone accountable, even if it was children shot in the back. So that's about it.
Uh-huh. That's quite a story. Okay. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say before we
wrap it up? Maybe more on that. It's just, I feel like it's... like the issue of suicide bombings, even though it's dealt with so much in the media,
mm-hmm.
I think if we ignore it, you know, it just leaves a lot of questions in people's, you know, people are wondering about it, you know, and so I, despite the fact that it does get so much attention and the hell that is living under occupation and the violence of the occupation really does not, I do feel, you know, the need to address it. And I'll just add about that, but again, when Barak was in power, and you know, in Israel it's very, you know, for a while you mostly only generals get elected, and in the beginning of the Intifada it was, I think, definitely Barak was, you know, showing all his, you know, military, you know, capabilities in responding to the Intifada, even though it was clear that it was just making, you know, it was just making the violence worse.
That's what this coming election looks like, too. I mean, the Labor guy is a former general.
Yeah. The only people that have chances to get elected in Israel, really, or to have any kind of real control of the country, because the army is so strong that if you're not an ex-general with ties in the army, you know, you can't really run the country. But yeah, when Barak wanted there to be quiet, when he didn't want any operations for about 2 weeks before the elections, his elections against Sharon, because he thought he had a chance of being reelected, he did. It was very interesting how he, you know, achieved that. He managed to achieve that, and he achieved that by actually lifting the siege, which is, you know, the roadblocks that have turned every Palestinian city and village into, you know, ghettos or prisons from which it's illegal to come and go. He removed that security measure of the siege. There were bulldozers, you know, zipping up and down the West Bank, removing these roadblocks. And he had negotiations. People had some hope, you know, the Taba negotiations, that people had some hope would actually, you know, move the process forward.
Oh, this was after Camp David.
This was after Camp David,
uh-huh.
Just before the elections.
Uh-huh.
And it was 2 weeks. You know, the situation was slightly improved. There was some kind of response to the Palestinian, you know, needs, and there was a chance, you know, a reason for hope. And there were no suicide bombings for those 2 weeks, you know, no attempt even of one. And again, it's just, for me, I think that, you know, the Israeli government, I cannot believe that they don't know that having the Palestinians, you know, starved and humiliated and, you know, pushed in a corner isn't something that's, you know, creating situations that encourage suicide bombings, especially things like assassinations where, you know, the head of either political or military factions are assassinated. And, you know, recently there was a situation where, because they couldn't assassinate Ahmed Sadat, who's being held by British and American guards, they assassinated his brother. I know that these kind of provocations, it's clear to everyone, and I'm sure it's clear to the Israeli army, provoke, you know, a response that costs the lives of Israeli civilians. But this is a price that they're willing to pay in order to make, you know, to reinforce the occupation. And
go ahead. There are people here who think that, like the United States, Israel has an interest in the occupation, and that it's I guess when you scratch the surface of it, that it has to do with weapon sales, arms manufacturing, and that life without it economically is not considered.
Well, you know, the majority of Israelis, that's the thing, that the majority of Israelis aren't interested in maintaining the occupation. I mean, would be happy to be done with the settlements. They're more being sucked into believing that they're defending themselves by maintaining the occupation. I think it's a very similar situation in the United States, where the majority of Americans aren't interested in a war on Iraq. They're not going to gain anything from it. They have a lot to lose from it,
right,
by becoming, you know, the enemies of the Arab and Muslim world. But those that are gaining from it, you know, whether it's the people that are profiting, you know, from the military aid that's coming to Israel, it's not the regular citizens, you know, or from the, there's industrial zones in the West Bank and Gaza, which are also enjoying, you know, cheap labor, you know, of Palestinians or of new immigrants that are put in settlements.
Mm-hmm.
To work there, and also are not being, where ecological laws are not being enforced, so that the occupied territories aren't being polluted,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to Israel. Those people, that's not the majority, you know, of Israelis, but they are people with money and power, and they're setting the policies that we as citizens are paying the price for. And people are sucked into supporting those policies because they feel that they're under attack and that they're in danger, and they're basically not being exposed to, you know, where those kinds of attacks are coming from, why they're being created.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of parallels. I mean, Americans are, you know, it's illegal for Americans to go to Iraq, just like it's illegal for Israelis now to come into the occupied territories. But once you go to these places, and like I can say from the time I've spent in, you know, Palestinian refugee camps, for example, when you see the hell that your government is creating, it's very clear that the only thing that can stop this hell from overflowing, you know, is if it changes, if the people are given, you know, some kind of reason or hope that their lives can be, you know, worth living. In the current condition of the people, you know, living in the occupied territories, nothing will be able to stop you know, people from committing suicide and wanting to take others with them. You know, not Arafat, you know, not the Israeli army, not anything. It's only hope that can change that. Just like in the Israeli side, you know, people need hope that they have a chance of living in peace if they're going to, you know, stop justifying the violence that's being used against Palestinians. I'm convinced that that hope exists and there's proof of it, but that's not what people are being shown by or told by their leaders or shown by the media.
Right. Yes, it's certainly not.
What is next? It seems to me, from this distance, it seems as though the Olive Harvest campaign has wrapped up, as mm-hmm. at least coming to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a war in Iraq on the horizon. Elections, one of which will happen and one of which is not likely to happen on the farther horizon. What are the International Solidarity Movement's plans for the near term?
Well, our next campaign is pretty much almost started. It's starting on the 15th of December, going to the 15th of January. Before we left Palestine a few weeks ago, you know, we had defined that the you know, at the last ISM core group meeting, that our focuses of the campaign would be the security wall, the security fence, and trying to protest the fact that it's being built on Palestinian land, and the humanitarian crisis in Rafah, which I mentioned before, where neighborhoods. Neighborhood O is being demolished completely in order to widen the security belt between the border of Egypt and Rafah. In the meantime, as always in Palestine, several other crises have occurred. So I know that there are activists in Bethlehem right now during the current invasion of Bethlehem. We also have permanent presence of internationals in the besieged and under curfew cities of Nablus and Qalqilia. And hopefully, if we have the more numbers, we hope also to have a permanent presence in Gaza and in Jenin. There's also a women's house that's been set up, IWPS, in the village of Haris, outside of Nablus. So we're starting to have these little pockets of permanent presences in places that are in permanent crisis, which we hope to expand on. And part of the January-December campaign is, you know, trying to amplify our presence in places of, you know, where we expect will be hard hit under the auspices of the war in Iraq. So trying to just kind of thicken our presence there a little bit. And the next campaign after that looks like it's, you know, we still have to announce it, but we'll probably be around spring, April, and then we're expecting another Freedom Summer. But the reality of ISM right now is that we have people working all the time. It's not campaign oriented, but during the campaigns, you know, it's when we try to focus and bring more and have a more focused effort. In certain, you know, where we can use bigger numbers to mobilize on specific issues.
Okay. If there are people among our listeners who would like to come to the Palestinian territories to work with you, what would you say to them and how would they contact you?
Well, people can contact us through email, internet, and phone, and www.palsolidarity.org.
Okay.
And if people go to that website or to the rapprochement.org website as well, they can find information about how to come to Palestine. And people know, should know also that we conduct a training and preparation for 2 days for people who want to join activities in which we try to provide them with information about the areas that they are going to be visiting or, you know, active in, and some legal briefing, some media information, some training about their safety in the actions. We don't want people to be injured or hurt by any chance. And also some things about the Palestinian culture and how they can best deal with Palestinians while being in their homes in order to avoid any misunderstanding or embarrassment or whatever. So we do a preparation for people when they come, and there is also training in nonviolence and how to deal and act with soldiers and settlers on different locations, checkpoints, roadblocks, or if you are in a refugee camp and all of that. And we have some kind of legal support where some lawyers volunteer some of their time to defend and represent the activists, and some Palestinian organizations like LAW. It's not a very big thing, but we try to do something that will enable and make it easier for the activists when they come to stay for some time in Palestine. So people come sometimes for 1 week, others for 2 weeks or 1 month, and people who come for longer than 3 months and are willing to take a coordination part, there's a chance, if they are interested and they have the ability to do that, to join the ISM core group and become active members in the core group and maybe coordinators in certain regions if that's available and possible. So people are welcome all the time, not necessarily in campaigns. And in the campaigns, as Netta mentioned, the work will be more focused towards a certain theme, but international presence is needed all the time, and we have managed to maintain permanent international presence since March 29th until today, and we have people staying with families in their houses for a long time sometimes.
Okay, and if we have listeners who are not prepared to come to Palestine but who want to keep up with the work that you're doing, am I right in saying that they can sign up for your mailing list at that website?
Yes. That's very true. So www.palsolidarity.org. You can sign up to get our updates. There's also information on how they can contribute money if that's how people want to support our work, and basic information on what you have to do to get into the country, because it's much better if you don't say that you're there to support peace or human rights or have anything to do with the occupied territories, because you'll definitely be turned back, at the airport and not allowed in. So a little basic guidelines on how to get in. And then once you're in, contact us and go through the training. And then within the training, people are split up into affinity groups, and the affinity group will be, told where the needs are in different places, and they can decide where they're going and take it from there. Just one more addition. It's like decisions in ISM are taken by consensus. So since we are asking people to take a certain level of risk, they have to be fully comfortable with whatever it is that they're doing. And so we need the process to be as democratic as possible. So when they're coming in, they're not coming to join a kind of army force, but a support force in which they can find the role that they feel comfortable with. We've had people, of all ages and from many different parts of the world. And there have been several Canadian activists that have been great, and we're expecting many more. There's now an ISM branch that has already been established in Montreal, and two in the process of being established in Toronto and Vancouver. And we'll see, now that we've come to Victoria, how the local activists here, what kind of initiatives they want to take to support the Canadian activists that are coming over. So hopefully there will also be a Canadian network that can support the activists while they're there, do their media work.
Is there contact information for those organizations that you could share with our listeners?
Hopefully the contact for the new branches will be also posted on the website. I don't think they're there. They're not there yet, but if you wait a week,
okay.
They will be up there.
Okay, that sounds good. We're just about out of time, and I'd like to give the two of you the last word. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to say, or something that you'd like to say to leave with our listeners?
Well, okay, I would say that by people coming to Palestine, Palestinians will feel that in a way or another they are heard, and there are some people who feel that there is injustice going on in their region, and that this has to come to an end. And they are not only feeling it and seeing it, but those internationals who come risk sometimes their not life, but sometimes risking that they might be hurt or injured, arrested, and harassed, and coming all this long distance is a very good support for Palestinians, and for people here who cannot come might be willing to support others to come. This will also help. The first thing is that awareness is the most important thing. And when people come to Palestine and come back to their countries, they do speaking tours, and they tell about what they have seen in Palestine, what they have witnessed, because they are really bearing witness to what is happening in the occupied territories and Palestinian areas. And maybe we can together put an end to the injustice going on and live in a better condition.
You've been listening to Peace Watch Middle East on CJLY 93.5 FM, Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, B.C., with your host, Jim Terrell, and technical assistance from Neil Sorokin. Today, I've been talking with George N. Rishmawi, a Palestinian, and Netta Golan, an Israeli. Both of them are founding members of the International Solidarity Movement. They are on a speaking tour of North America. Today's show is first broadcast on December 6th, 2002, and will be rebroadcast on December the 13th. Don't touch that dial. Stay tuned for Mike Daglish next on Sports Talk.